are strong partners with DMV. As you know, when you buy a new car or a used car, you're giving them your title and registration money. They're filling out the application form for you. They're sending it in and distributing the plates and stickers through you. We have partnerships with industry in giving our drive tests, as well as a strong partnership with DEQ on registration renewal. You go to a DEQ center and get, and they will also perform their registration renewal at the same time they're doing the inspections. We're really all about transactions, millions of transactions. So we issue about 1.1 million driver licenses a year and ID cards, 1.2 million vehicle titles, which is, of course, one of the reasons why adding additional fees to the title transaction fee was so attractive in terms of helping support highway funds. We register vehicles, 2 million a year, and then recording convictions, et cetera. So as you can see, we are a very intense processing shop. We have performance...
Excuse me, Representative Breyer.
Can you just go back a second? On the electronic access, you said that you'd be able to register by electronically by when?
Mr. Chair, Representative Breyer, we're planning by the end of this biennium. We have a contractor on board, and we are hoping through an aggressive schedule to get online vehicle registration done by the end of this biennium. If not, then it'll be shortly thereafter.
And we're talking a 103.
Yeah, like in 6 months.
Thank you.
On the next page, you see some of our performance measures, customer satisfaction and service levels. Monthly, we survey our customers to see what their level of satisfaction is with our service. The top line represents their general satisfaction with our helpfulness, courtesy, knowledge, and efficiency. The lower line, of course, is wait time satisfaction. We're an impatient public, and even though we have an average wait time of 15 minutes, you know, everybody wants their service faster, so... We have about a 60% satisfaction level with wait time. These are a couple examples below there of service delivery. We have at least 11 measures of service delivery. I just showed a couple because these are the kinds of things that people pay attention to. Turnaround time on getting our titles out, as well as office wait time. And you can see the variations in the wait time, of course, depend upon summer and winter. We have a higher population in our field offices in the summer. School is out. More kids are getting their driver licenses. More cars are sold in the spring and summertime. And we just, in general, have that cyclical activity. A couple of measures of business effectiveness. As you see, productivity, we measure our transactions per hour. And we've been trying to maintain and continue our level of productivity given the fact that we'll be having fewer people to work and the transaction volume isn't changing. We look at more and more ways to automate, cross-train, anything that we can to make sure that we are continuing to meet our service levels. And the other chart there shows our growth in return to the highway fund of receipts after we subtract the DMV budget. The driver safety performance measure is a new one for us. We've been concentrating in the past primarily on these efficiency and effectiveness efficiency measures, productivity measures, and we wanted to begin to take a look at how can we affect driver safety. So this is a new measure. We only have 2 or 3 years' worth of data, and we're wanting to take a look at what programs and what improvements in our driver safety programs can we have to change this measure. And how it relates is that our assumption is that this number represents the percentage of Oregonians with 3 years without any accidents or convictions on their record. Our assumption is the fewer accidents, the fewer traffic violations you get, the less likely you are to end up in an accident or a fatality. So that it's a measure to our way of thinking of your safe driving ability, and we want to see what we can do about affecting that measure. So what you see right there is simply a compilation of what the historic pattern has been before we've actually taken an examination of what our programs, in conjunction, of course, with all the other programs, might do to change that measure. On the following page, give you just a sense of our customer focus. What we're looking for is fast, efficient, high-quality service. options with doing business with DMV, and that's one of the reasons, obviously, for opening the Internet transaction door. So you've got walk-in in the office, which is probably the most expensive way to do business with DMV. Mail-in, which is very efficient, but not everyone chooses that. Phone, we have an interactive voice system, and that's used primarily for obtaining records from our account holders. Internet right now primarily to provide information on how to do business conveniently with DMV, but soon we'll be able to do transactions over the Internet. And, of course, one of our goals is to make sure that we have confidential treatment of the information in the DMV database. DMV database is a source of information that a lot of people would like to have access to. Law enforcement, of course, has access to everything in it. Other than that, there are various layers of access depending upon what the state and federal privacy laws allow. Our service through partnerships, I talked a little bit about that. We have registrations through DEQ. Of course, vehicle and title and registration through dealers. We have third-party testers for both commercial and our regular, you know, Class C driver license. The schools are good partners with us in proctoring exams, and in fact, their last session we did pass a law that would allow schools to actually use their drive tests in lieu of our own drive tests. Partnership with the Department of Corrections, a successful long-term partnership. We've been working with them for 15 years, and our call center now employs 40 inmates. Snow park permits going through retail outlets, and, of course, we have worked closely with citizen and stakeholder advisory groups on our programs. I've given you just an outline of the DMV in motion, which is our strategic plan that guides the development of our biennial plan for each, essentially our service group plan. We each biennium we take a look at our strategic direction and say which initiatives do we want to focus on in particular this biennium to further our goals of getting the job done right the first time, making sure roads are safer, protecting vehicle interest, and making sure that the public has confidence in a well-managed and well-run DMV. Accomplishments for this biennium, we seem to be an area in which there's a lot of interest in bill activity. We're usually tracking over 200 to 300 bills a year, a session. There were 36 bills last time affecting DMV. Some of them raised funds for the Oregon Transportation Investment Act. We extended vehicle registration to 4 years for brand new vehicles. That just reduces the transactions that the public and the DMV need to have with each other. Reduce the abuse of trip permits by limiting trip permits to only 2 21-day trip permits. Unfortunately, trip permits were being used in the DEQ areas in lieu of registration for cars that could not pass the DEQ because you could get at least 120 days. We've also implemented some additional safeguards on issuing driver licenses replacements. We've just recently launched a pilot program to allow car dealers to register entitled vehicles electronically and issue plates and stickers right there at the point of sale. So there are 9 dealerships involved in that, and when you go to those dealerships, you can, in addition to what you've normally done in the past, which is to give them your title and registration fees, and they've filled out the paperwork, bundled it up, and taken it to a DMV field office, who in turn then issue the plates and stickers back to the dealer, and they then distribute it to you. Now it's all done in one process. They've got some software that has been developed through a third-party integrator who then handles the program, signs them up, and the customer does have a choice about whether or not they want to do this. Some dealerships may charge an additional fee, others may not. But we see this as a win-win for us, reduces our transactions, allows the customers quick access to their license plates and registration stickers. Just another way of extending the partnership. We are working very closely with the medical community to implement our authority to expand the conditions that are now mandatorily need to be reported for individuals who have some medical problem. In the past, it has been primarily if you have suffered a loss of consciousness, and it's only been a neurologist that have been required to report. In the last session, a bill was passed that would expand that to through rulemaking to a broad range of medical professionals and essentially a broad range of medical conditions that could affect driving. This has been a very difficult, time-consuming bill to work through all the issues. In fact, the issue paper, one of the issue papers at the end of my discussion references that, but we are set to set the rules out this month. And if all goes well, start it in phases, with the first phase starting in May. We're targeting the southwest counties, six southwest counties, Lane County essentially down to the coast, and to start this out with and work through the issues, because it is needs to be a good partnership between ourselves as well as the physician community to make sure that this works. We have...
Sure.
Representative Green.
Can we get copies of that plan when it is about to get implemented?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, in fact, I was hoping for an opportunity as we got closer to implementation to come back and give a report to this committee about what we've learned in the public hearing process and where we're going from here. So if that suits the pleasure of the committee, that's what I would be intending to do.
We'll see it happen.
Thank you very much. We have secured a contract to replace our digital photo license, and it will be an upgrade with quite a few additional security features. As I say, we're ready to launch an internet project. We've been continuously working on our DMV website, which is probably one of the more popular, right next to TripCheck at an ODOT, as a place to go to get information. Where are the field offices, their hours, a lot of information about how to transact business with DMV. And then, of course, as I said earlier, we transitioned the call center from here in Salem up to Coffee Creek facility with essentially no interruption in service. So what's next for the upcoming biennium? We have three strategies that we intend to focus on. The first one is driver safety, improving our programs to promote safe driving. The second one is fraud prevention, covering both identity theft as well as fraud related to vehicle ownership and condition of vehicles. And what I'm talking about there is the fact that vehicles not only carry on the title a statement of who owns it and who is in has a financial interest in it, the bank or who else might be loaning money on it, but if a vehicle has a condition problem, such as it was flood damaged or it was reconstructed from having been in an accident, there are various brands on vehicles that essentially give the owner or the potential buyer information about the previous history of that vehicle, as well as a statement on the odometer. And odometer fraud as well as brand washing are two ways in which the condition of the vehicle can be misrepresented to the public and therefore defrauding people of several hundreds of thousands of dollars, or millions essentially, across the United States. And then the third initiative is DMV from home, and we've titled that primarily as a way of capturing attention of both our customers as well as our staff. And the goal there is to try and figure out how to keep people out of DMV field offices. It's not like we're offering Starbucks coffee, and what we're trying to try and do is give people plenty of alternatives for waiting in line in the DMV office, either the internet or the phone or mail-in, so encourage people to you access DMV services in other ways. A little bit more about our driver safety. Of course, the biggest effort on the driver safety side for this coming biennium will be the implementation of the expanded requirements for the medically impaired drivers. And we're as a companionship to that, we are also going to develop a community-based partnership to support public outreach for what we're calling a safe mobility campaign. As you can understand, that the highest proportion of individuals who are going to find themselves in the position of having some medical impairment to affect their driving behavior are the aging population. And they need more than just DMV to take their driver license away. They need alternatives to driving. They need assistance from the community. They need to figure out ways in which they can stay mobile for as long as possible. And that's going to need a broad-based outreach. We want to work closely with Transportation Safety Division, which I think has an excellent record for developing these broad-based coalitions, to look at ways in which we can launch these two things simultaneously. where we're doing much more research into the demographics of problem drivers to try and understand whether or not our own driver improvement programs, the administrative programs that we have, as well as what the courts are doing, hardship permits, suspensions, what effect are they having? Well, you really need to understand where is the problem driving occurring, in what age group, is it rural, is it versus urban, as the preliminary analysis we've done, the major problems that people are having across all age groups is speeding. And as you probably heard last Friday from Troy Costales in his presentation, that speed now, more than intoxicated driving, is one of the major causes of fatal crashes and crashes in general here in Oregon. And then also we're looking at whatever we need to do in the way of implementing federal changes to licensing commercial drivers. Commercial drivers are the only drivers that are under federal regulation. Otherwise, regular Class C, what we call Class C driver license, those are all state-by-state regulations. Under our fraud prevention initiative, we want to continue our partnership with industry and other agencies. Right now, we're kind of part of an ad hoc working group called the Identity Theft Task Force, in which we're working with other state agencies, law enforcement, as well as the private sector, financial and retail, to figure out ways in which we can reduce the misuse of driver licenses and other documents for identity theft. That's one of the reasons why we're looking at improving the security features of our own driver license to prevent its ability to be altered. We had received authority last session for changes in title brands. We want to broaden and title brand list. There is not a standard list of title brands across the United States. They're not all done the same way. They're not really clear. And what we want to make sure is that we have captured all the main kinds of damage that can occur to into cars, and that our title that is a branded title is very clear, that when somebody has it, they know that there's a problem or has been a historic problem with that car. We also want to evaluate the possessory lien process, and that is where people who have some sort of financial interest in the vehicle can file a lien against it. Probably the most obvious example of those are the tow companies, who file liens against vehicles that have been abandoned and are sitting in their storage, and now they're trying to recover the cost of that. But there are many other individuals, apartment owners with abandoned vehicles, or even individuals who have loaned a friend some money, and that friend has not paid it back, and so they file a possessory lien against that vehicle. And we want to make sure that that process is not being abused. And then finally, we want to take a look at connecting with the National Motor Vehicle Title Information System, a database developed through an American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators. More and more states are beginning to get on that, and then you will be able to online inquire at the time of titling what's the title history of this vehicle as it moves into the state. In particular, what is the history in terms of brands? We are currently do check all vehicles against the national list of stolen vehicles, but title brands are not on there, and that's probably one of the weaker areas that we need to shore up. And then finally, under DMV from home, expand our internet transactions beyond the two that we've got now. We want to look at ordering custom plates and individual driver licenses online. We want to take a look at improving the website navigation and the information content of the web. And then also look at our partners to see if there are more ways in which they can submit information to us online, as well as online submission to things like notices of sale of vehicles. The transition papers I've talked about a little bit briefly. The first one on driver license integrity and security is arising more and more out of course 9/11, and the use of fraudulent driver licenses by the terrorists has sparked a national look at the whole issue of states' role in issuing identity documents, because you can't travel now without government-issued ID, and government-issued ID comes from DMVs. So there is now a national interest in the quality of the licenses as well as looking at perhaps a national approach to it, so the national standard, and in particular looking at adding some sort of a biometric beyond your face or your signature, a thumbprint or something like that. So we're keeping close track of national legislation that may start looking at uniformity for driver licenses.
Lorna, if an individual comes to DMV seeking an ID card, what kind of documentation is required for them to prove who they are?
Mr. Chair, they need to have proof of their identity as well as proof that they are here in Oregon. So what we look at are things such as birth certificates, passports if they're from another country, or other immigration documents, social security cards. We have levels of primary and secondary ID for one of the issues that we're facing is the fact that, of course, here in Oregon, there is no requirement that you be legally present in the United States in order to be issued a driver license. So we're looking at a lot of foreign birth certificates. And that's probably, we've identified across the nation, one of the biggest issues is that in order for us to issue the driver license, we're looking at a lot of paper documents. And the authenticity of those original paper documents, such as birth certificates, is something that we're struggling with. The National Association of Registrars are also looking at some way at which they can, because birth certificates, even in the United States, are very, very different. Consular cards are another thing that people are looking at, where the consulates will, in fact, look at the identity documents of the individuals coming. And the passport really is an identity document issue, but there are many people in the United States who don't have passports and who've come in here without having to have passports. So for us, it is a difficult process to sort out and make sure that you are who you are and that your documents are authentic. And it's a problem across the United States, and I think that's certainly why there is some national interest in trying to standardize that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, follow up on your question. In Woodburn, in my district, it said that all you need is an envelope with an address on it. You don't even have to live in Woodburn. You can walk. You can come up illegal, come into town, get an envelope that shows an address in Woodburn, go into DMV, and you got your driver's license, and then from there all the other identification starts to work around our community. And I don't doubt that for a second, but could that be possible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, the envelope with an address on it is one way, or in other words, canceled mail with your name and address on it is one way of establishing that you actually live here in Oregon, but it's not used for your identity. And you do not need to live in Woodburn in order to get a driver license or the ID card in Woodburn. You can go to any field office. We know there are problems with the issue of establishing residency in Oregon. And the balancing that trick that we're stuck with is there is a fair number of people who really don't have a long-term permanent address. There are the homeless. There are people who are in transition a lot. And since we don't have, as I've stated earlier, a requirement that you be legally present in the U.S., our primary issue has always been that you are who you say you are, so when I issue a driver license to you, I know I'm issuing a driver license to you. Now that we have been put in a position, or the position that we've been in has become more and more important in terms of now you are the agency that establishes identity for people, for travel and everything else, then what we've been trying to do to accommodate the fact that there is a transient population that drives here in Oregon, now is beginning to get sort of, if you will, bite us, and we have to figure out how to deal with that. But we can consider it a policy decision on the part of the legislature as to the intrinsic requirements to get a driver license. And so we can't tell somebody just because you're not legally present in the U.S., I won't give you a driver license, which is why people, well, we're having more difficulty making sure that we always have the best of the documentation.
Thank you. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What about the title loan business, and what kind of issues are you facing or are you trying to deal with in regard to people taking out, you know, getting a loan on their title and possibly coming in then to get a replacement title and sell the vehicle?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I understand that issue, and it's a difficult one in that usually title loans are meant to be short-term loans. So there's rarely an effort for the title loan company to get their interest recorded on that title, because it's about a 20-21 day turnaround process, $30 to apply for a title fee, and they're holding the title in their hands. So the issue has been brought before us, but we haven't come up yet with a good way of putting any kind of notation on the record or compelling someone to notify us when they've essentially secured a short-term loan through a title loan company and the loaner of the money does not submit a request to have themselves put on the title.
Thank you, Lorna. Go ahead.
So, as I was saying, you can read through this paper at your leisure. Driver license integrity and security is an issue much broader than just driving anymore, and it is one in which there is considerable national interest. And then a second issue, and I've spoken to that already, is the issue of improving driver safety, which is needs to be a strong partnership between ourselves and the physician community, because what the statute now requires is not that the physician reports you when you have an illness. Like, let's say you've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. You're not required as a physician to report the patients that have had that diagnosis. What you are required to do is report your Alzheimer's patients when, in your best medical judgment, their disease has progressed to the point that they are so impaired that they can no longer safely drive. And what we've done in our rules is attempted to the best of our ability and guided by information or some excellent work done by the American Medical Association, develop a list of the kinds of impairments that affect driving to guide physicians so that they say, well, when your cognitive abilities or your judgment is that you can no longer, and then we say, as a result of that, you can't make a decision about how to react to traffic or you get lost, et cetera. It gives them a translation document. Probably the most difficult aspect of it is the legislation has given physicians immunity from suit for reporting, but their concern there is now growing about what if they fail to report? What if in their medical judgment they don't think someone's ready to report and that person gets into an accident? There are at least a couple cases certainly we've been sued for that, and there's been one suit brought against a physician for failure to report. Now, that suit was heard in favor of the physician, but that concern is out there, and we may see legislation on that subject. So we're going to need to feel our way through this process very carefully, because without a good partnership with the physician community, it will not work, and we need to be very careful about undue liability for them as well. And then finally, the very end is a list of the pre-session filed bills. There's about a dozen of them. I'll only bring three of them to your attention. The first one is a hardship permits and probationary permits. Essentially, when you get a driver license suspended, the law allows for a number of various types of suspensions and ability to get what we call a hardship permit, which is essentially a permit that allows you to drive a certain route or a certain time. It's a restricted driver license. And what we want to do is add two additional items to that to allow you to drive to and from drug treatment, because before it was only just alcohol treatment. And obviously one of the reasons that people are getting suspended is drug intoxication. And then also allow you to drive not just to retain employment, but to seek employment, which we think, particularly in these hard times, is an important expansion. We want to allow a change of address by telephone because there are similar sorts of safeguards would be in place in terms of the kinds of information we would ask of you before we would do that. And then also we want to eliminate taking out-of-state junk certificates. In other words, if a car comes in here with a junk certificate, which means this car should not be running on the road anymore, we don't want to issue any kind of a title to it. Essentially, it sits with that junk certificate, and it gets sent off to a recycler. And then, of course, Kelly will be talking to you at length about all the other bills that we have pre-session filed. And with that, that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you may have.
Any questions, Lorna? Guess not. Thank you, Lorna.
Thank you very much.
Really appreciate you being here this morning. Okay. Well, committee, we're going to get the opportunity to have our first hearing on a bill this morning. And with that, I would open the public hearing on House Bill 2035. Janet, will you give us a rundown on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2035 takes care of a technical problem with the funding, one of the funding sources for Lincoln County's Transit District. When the Transit District was formed in 1996, it formed under a county service facilities chapter in ORS, Chapter 451, whereas most transit districts form under a separate chapter that deals with transit districts specifically. When the district was formed in 1996, the state and the county considered the county eligible for a program of receiving state money for the state employees that work and drive and need transportation in the county. This is a state agency assessment program, also referred to sometimes as in lieu of payroll tax, because the state doesn't in lieu of property tax, because the state doesn't pay either property or payroll tax to transit districts. It was determined last year, because of the formation under Chapter 451, that statute was not listed in the defining statute for this assessment program, and so it was determined by the Attorney General last year that the county district was no longer eligible and had never been eligible to receive these payments from the state. This bill would add eligibility to Lincoln County, and it's my understanding that that's the only district that would be affected by the change in House Bill 2035. It would also make the change retroactive. Section 2 of the bill makes the change retroactive so that Lincoln County doesn't face paying back the money that they have received and have spent on transit services. And there's a number of people to speak to you about the bill today, but that's kind of the basic outline.
Thank you, Jenna. These people here. You bring two of them up at a time with your office. We'll call three of them up, three of the witnesses up at a time. Cinda Bruce, Roger Martin, and Rob Bovet.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Transit Association. And I thought maybe it would be helpful to give you an overview of the background of all of this particular area of transit financing. And then Cinda and Rob can give you the particular problems that affect Lincoln County, which you've already heard from Janet Adkins. And I'm sure you'll quickly want to pass the bill. The Oregon legislature 30 years ago established various kinds of public transportation districts in the state of Oregon. There are today three transit districts, 8 transportation districts and about 15 cities that provide mostly fixed service kinds of transportation. There are a number of other districts or entities in the state of Oregon that provide senior and disabled transportation. Those vary from public to nonprofit, private agencies, and we won't get into those right now. Oregon recognizes that many communities in our 36 counties are different, and that's why there are different entities. Lincoln County chose to go the way they went, and they'll describe that to you. But early on, the two first transit districts, which were TriMet in the Portland Tri-County area, Lane Transit in Lane County, were given the right to collect a payroll tax on private payrolls. About 10 years later, the then Governor Vic Attia recognized that it was rather unfair to charge private employers for the full portion of the local monies that went to operate the transit district, when a good share of the ridership did not go to private entities, but went, as an example, in Lane Transit in Eugene. Over 50% of the ridership is probably students at the University of Oregon or other public institutions and government employees, and yet it was the private payrolls that were supporting the entire system. The state recognized that and passed what is known as an in lieu of payroll tax, which is almost invisible in state government. It is paid by all government agencies other than those that have federal funding totally supporting them. We can't tax the federal government, unfortunately. If you can figure out a way to do it, we'll be happy to assist in that. But all other units of government, originally it was just the state agencies, now it includes cities, counties, and public schools, pay a portion similar to what the private payrolls are in recognition of the fact that they are transporting a good number of passengers who either go to public schools or who work in public employment. It's a key role for the state, and we hope that you'll recognize that. In the case of Lincoln County, they ran afoul of the Attorney General's office, a ruling a few years ago, which kind of falls in the category. I wonder why they went this far to do this, to interrupt something that's going on. And this bill simply wants to cure a idealistic Attorney General's opinion that really doesn't make good common sense. With that, I'll end and let Senator carry it.
Mr. Chair, representatives, between Ms. Atkins and the summary you've just heard, you've probably already heard.
Rob, could you
Introduce myself? My name is Rob Bovette, Assistant County Counsel from Lincoln County, for the record. I have provided you written testimony that basically summarizes what Ms. Atkins just summarized and what you just heard, and I won't bore you with the details of that. What I think I'll throw in to the mix, just so you know, is why we set it up under Chapter 451 rather than 267, and there's a real rational reason that made sense then and it still makes sense now, and why I think the legislature enabled transit districts to be established under 451 in the first place. 451 is a county service district provision, and it allows you, when you have a district that's going to cover an entire county, to essentially set it up as not really a department, as a separate entity from the county, but you don't have to establish things like separate boards, separate legal counsel, separate finance administration, personnel. And essentially, we saved a whole lot of money in our transit program, and we're able to redirect all of the transit money into direct services by saving money by keeping it within the county system. And that was the reason back we set it up under 451 back in 1996. Made sense then. It still makes sense now. But then we got stung by this Attorney General opinion last year, and it has a potentially devastating effect. I mean, the state has. I got to give the state credit, both the DAS and ODOT, a whole lot of credit for working with us closely to not have us get stung real hard, at least initially. They've sent us this contract, which they'd like us to sign, which basically would require us to repay almost $250,000, and I probably don't have to tell you that repaying $250,000 out of the Lincoln County Transit Program pretty much wipes us out. But they've told us, and they've been very nice, they've continued to collect the assessments and impound the assessments, and they're holding on to them for us if we can get this legislation passed. And they've told us we don't have to do this if we can get this legislation passed. So that's why we're here today. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Any questions? Cinda.
I would just like to encourage your support of House Bill 2035. It is very important to the Lincoln County Transportation Service District to maintain current services.
Thank you. Is there any questions? You guys got it easy this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative, former Representative Terry Thompson, and now County Commissioner. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning. Former Representative Terry Thompson, now County Commissioner for Lincoln County. I'm only here to just testify to the good job that's gone on in the district. We have a high number of seniors in our district, and this transportation system has done a great job of allowing them mobility throughout the county. It's a good project, and I encourage you to pass this bill and let us keep doing the good work that we've accomplished in the last few years.
Thank you. Any questions, Attorney?
Well,
Representative Iyer.
And I don't know if this needs to go to you, but since this only affects you, are you the only district that did this under 451?
I'll have to turn around and look at Rob Bovette because he's the one that...
They're not in their head forward.
The answer is yes, because I haven't examined the other districts in the state.
Okay. And a follow-up. If someone else should do this, or I don't know whether there'd be anyone else that would do this, then this would affect them going forward.
I don't.
Rob, would you like to come forward?
Yeah, he better.
This was this...
I didn't think
when I get up here, they ask questions, Rob.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, the answer is yes, and it makes sense because if you have someone that was facing the same situation we were in and they chose 451 versus 267, it only makes sense that they qualify for the program as well. That's what everybody thought was the case in 1996 anyways.
Thank you.
Rob is my legal counsel as county commissioner, so I'm very fortunate to have him there.
Any other questions?
The keeper.
Thank you, Terry. And that's the... Martin Loring? Good morning, Martin.
Good morning, Chair Brown. I'm Martin Loring. I manage the Public Transit Division within the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I suppose I should start off by confessing I'm the dirty, no-good so-and-so who discovered the problem and set in motion the process to remedy it one way or the other.
Idealistic.
I think your administrator, Janet Atkins, set out the problem for you very well. I'd like to touch on a couple of points. This is really a tale of three Oregon Revised Statutes chapters and how they interplay. When the Mass Transit Assessment Program was created in 1981, it was set out in ORS 291-405 and 291-407. The public policy purpose it serves is to have the state participate in the cost of services that benefit the state. That is to say, where a local government delivers transportation services, the state benefits by their employees being able to get to and from work on the bus. In theory, the state doesn't have to build as many large parking lots for state employees, so there's a benefit. The primary source of funding for these local services is either a local payroll tax or a local property tax, neither of which the state pays. So this program is an in-lieu-of-tax program that recognizes the benefit the state receives. The problem is the way the statute was written, the shorthand that legislative council uses to define what's transit. It exists in this statute. It exists in a couple of others. But what it says is if you organize under this provision of Oregon law, ORS 267-010, or this provision of law, 267-450, the first being for mass transit districts, the second being for transportation districts, then this the statute, the mass transit assessment statute, affects you. What it doesn't recognize and couldn't, because these other entities didn't exist in 1981 when this law was passed, is that there are that you or that the legislature in passing law has created other entities that that may and do deliver the same transportation services that benefit the state. And the Lincoln County Transportation Service District, organized under Chapter 451 of the Oregon Revised Statute, is one of those. It is the only county service district in the state that delivers transportation services. If other counties wanted to organize this way, they could, and the effect under the bill before you today would also make them eligible. But there are none other at the current time. This was a good faith error. This statute is administered by the Department of Administrative Services. They look to the Oregon Department of Transportation for help in providing them with information. When the district was formed back in 96, June of 96, they initially started down the path to form a transportation district. That was our understanding at the time, as near as I can reconstruct the record. But for the very good reasons that Mr. Bovet explained, the county changed their mind about organizational form, and we didn't know about that change at the time, and none of us realized that there were some consequences to that change. And that consequence is that they made themselves ineligible to receive payments under this particular program. We discovered that late in 2002 and have been working with them and the Department of Administrative Services and the Department of Justice to try to remedy it ever since. The net effect is if you pass this bill, you will retroactively fix the problem. They won't have to repay the money that the state has already paid them, some $222,000 and change, and they would continue to receive these programs, these payments, which average about $4,200 a month. If you don't pass this bill, then they will not receive any additional payments. The two quarters payments that have been assessed against state agencies but held pending resolution of this issue will go back to the state agencies affected, and the state under law must seek repayment of the $222,000 plus interest that we didn't have the legal authority to make. Be happy to answer any questions. I think the facts are before you.
Thank you, Martin. Any questions? No question. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, that includes the witnesses on the major day, and I'll close the. Is there any comments from the committee? If not, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2035 and open work session on House Bill 2035. Do I hear a motion? Yes.
Mr. Chair, I would like to mention something that I just noticed, that there is not an emergency clause on the bill, and I'm not sure of the effect of that in terms of when the payments would be able to restart from DAS, or whether their obligation to repay the money makes any difference with or without an emergency clause. The bill is retroactive once it takes effect, but in terms of not having an emergency clause, I'm not sure of the difference it makes. And the other thing I wanted to mention on the bill that we have taken care of is there was a subsequent, the Speaker Office put a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee on the bill, but because it doesn't affect the budget, it's an ongoing program, and the Ways and Means Office has let us know, and we've checked with the Chair of the Ways and Means Committee, that it does not need to go to the Ways and Means Committee, so this committee can pass it to the floor without the and rescind the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. It will go directly to the floor. But I have not followed up to with the question of the emergency clause and whether that would be something it needs in order for them to get their money sooner or not have to pay the money back.
I can. Yes, Rob, would you come back up and clarify this for us, please?
I think the only effect of adding an emergency clause would be that the impounded money that the state is continuing to collect will be released to us earlier rather than later. It would go into effect, obviously, in July or August or whenever the bill was passed, rather than the end of the year. So that would be nice. On the other hand, I don't want to hold up the bill. It could also be added on the Senate side, an emergency clause, should that be desired and seek concurrence in the House. And that may be a more efficient way to go.
One thing I want to say is that the effective date's January. If there's no emergency clause, the effective date's January 1st of 2004.
Right.
So that's quite a ways out.
Another 6 months or so beyond when.
Yeah. Why don't I close the work session, and then we'll hold this till Wednesday and add the emergency clause at that time.
Do you need a motion to amend it to do that?
We'll get the amendment worked out. That's okay. And so that completes your business for the day, then, huh? Without objection, I'll say that we're adjourned for the day, then.
Great.
Works for me.